Welcome to the Cory Doctorow podcast. I'm Cory Doctorow, and once again, I am here reading to you from Bruce Sterling's amazing book, The Hacker Crackdown, a history of the early days of the civil liberties movement on the global intertubes. Bruce wrote this book in 1992, and in the PDF I've been working from, it runs about 174 pages, and I'm up at page 120. I'm doing about 5 pages per week, so I'm guessing this will take me right through to about when the baby is due, which is like the end of January, early February, providing I don't miss any weeks around then. And I expect that once the baby turns up, I might be taking a little hiatus. I'm sure you understand. What's going on? Well, I just got back from Vienna. Boy, are my arms tired. BA was their usual incompetent and terrible selves. This time they really outdid themselves on the way in. We had a 6:45 a.m. departure from Heathrow on Friday. We all got on the plane at about 6:10, 6 o'clock, and they pushed back from the gate, closed the door, and then they said, ladies and gentlemen, we are having some air traffic control problems. They wanted us to get off the stand, but we will not be taking off for another hour and a half. We're just going to wheel the plane over here to this lonely bit of tarmac and just sit here with you strapped in for the next 90 minutes. No, no, you can't get off and walk around the airport. Just sit here. Apparently there's a European directive that penalizes airlines that don't push back from the gate on time, but does not penalize them for pushing back from the gate and then not going anywhere. You may remember that I recently had another experience with Ryanair, where we took off from London's Stansted Airport to go to Berlin, and what they didn't tell us was that there were no planes landing at Berlin that day because of terrible windstorms. No, they didn't tell us that until we were on descent, at which point they announced it and said, so we're taking you to Hamburg. There will be buses along in the next 2 or 3 hours. They'll take about 3 hours to get into Berlin. Now, I had to be speaking the next morning. I couldn't wait. I ended up taking, yes, a taxi, €330 to go from Hamburg to Berlin in a taxi. Not fun at all. Really, really awful. And boy, I'm not very happy about it. So, air travel is not fun anymore. Air travel has not been fun for some time. And the good news is that with the Vienna trip done, I'm never going to travel again until the end of February. That means about 3 months of no travel. And I was doing the math in my head, and I think this is the longest no-fly period in my life since at least 1997, maybe as far back as 1995. So getting into about 10 to 12 years of continuous air travel, and finally taking my first hiatus from it. And I could not be looking forward to it more. I know lots of people think that, they just say you should travel less, and that's an interesting and useful bit of advice. I wish I could travel less, but the fact is that the way I earn my living and the way that I fight for the causes I fight for and the way that I stay in touch with people who care about my work means that I got to get on an airplane every now and again, and every now and again turns out to be pretty frequently. But I have the world's greatest excuse, which is that I'm about to fission into a second entity with the help of my lovely and talented fiancé, and when that happens, I'm going to have to sit at home and be vomited on, and so I can't leave and get on an airplane. And everyone seems to understand this. They understand that being the target of vomit is an important bit of the survival and prolongation of our species. And when you tell them, no, I can't come because I will have a puling poo machine in my arms, then they say, ah, yes, we understand entirely. No, no problem at all, which is great. Thank you to everyone who's been understanding about that. So, you know, I'm not really thinking that she's going to be a vomiting, puling machine. I think that she's going to be a lovely delight. And my friend Ben Rosenbaum, with whom I'm working on a delightful novella called True Names, not to be confused with Werner Vinge's True Names. True Names, Ben tells me that if you sniff the baby's head after it emerges and just keep smelling it, that there's some kind of volatile in there that changes your brain chemistry so that poo is cute. I'm taking him at his word here. Okay, let's read some of Bruce Sterling's amazing Hacker Crackdown. America's computer police are an interesting group. As a social phenomenon, they are far more interesting and far more important than teenage phone freaks and computer hackers. First, they're older and wiser. Not dizzy hobbyists with leaky morals, but seasoned adult professionals with all the responsibilities of public service. And, unlike hackers, they possess not merely technical power alone, but heavy-duty legal and social authority. And, very interestingly, they are just as much at sea in cyberspace as everyone else. They are not happy about this. Police are authoritarian by nature, and prefer to obey rules and precedents. Even those police who secretly enjoy a fast ride in rough territory will soberly disclaim any cowboy attitude. But in cyberspace, there are no rules or precedents. They are groundbreaking pioneers, cyberspace rangers, whether they like it or not. In my opinion, any teenager enthralled by computers, fascinated by the ins and outs of computer security, and attracted by the lure of specialized forms of knowledge and power, would do well to forget all about hacking and set his or her sights on becoming a Fed. Feds can trump hackers at almost every single thing hackers do, including gathering intelligence, undercover disguise, trashing, phone tapping, building dossiers, networking, infiltrating computer systems, criminal computer systems. Secret Service agents know more about freaking, coding, and carding than most freaks can find out in years. And when it comes to viruses, break-ins, software bombs, and Trojan horses, feds have direct access to red-hot, confidential information that is only vague rumor in the underground. And if it's an impressive public rep you're after, there are few people in the world who can be so chillingly impressive as a well-trained, well-armed U.S. Secret Service agent. Of course, a few personal sacrifices are necessary in order to obtain that power and knowledge. First, you'll have the galling discipline of belonging to a large organization. But the world of computer crime is still so small and so amazingly fast-moving that it will remain spectacularly fluid for years to come. The second sacrifice is that you'll have to give up ripping people off. This is not a great loss. Abstaining from the use of illegal drugs, also necessary, will be a boon to your health. A career in computer security is not a bad choice for a young man or woman today. The field will almost certainly expand drastically in years to come. If you are a teenager today, by the time you become a professional, the pioneers you have read about in this book will be the grand old men and women of the field, swamped by their many disciples and successors. Of course, some of them, like William P. Wood of the 1865 Secret Service, may well be mangled in the whirring machinery of legal controversy. But by the time you enter the computer crime field, it may have stabilized somewhat, while remaining entertainingly challenging. But you can't just have a badge. You have to win it. First, there's the federal law enforcement training, and it's hard. It's a challenge. A real challenge. Not for wimps and rodents. Every Secret Service agent must complete grueling courses at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. In fact, Secret Service agents are periodically retrained during their entire careers. In order to get a glimpse of what this might be like, I traveled myself to FLETC. The Federal Law Enforcement Training Center is a 1,500-acre facility on Georgia's Atlantic coast. It's a milieu of marsh grass, seabirds, damp, clinging sea breezes, palmettos, mosquitoes, and bats. Until 1974, it was a Navy air base, and it still features a working runway and some World War II vintage blockhouses and officers' quarters. The center has since benefited by a $40 million retrofit, but there's still enough forest and swamp on the facility for the Border Patrol to put in tracking practice. As a town, Glencoe scarcely exists. The nearest real town is Brunswick, a few miles down Highway 17, where I stayed at the aptly named Marshview Holiday Inn. I had Sunday dinner at a seafood restaurant called Gin Rights, where I feasted on deep-fried alligator tail. This local favorite was a heap basket of bite-sized chunks of white, tender, almost fluffy reptile meat, steaming in a peppered batter crust. Alligator makes a culinary experience that's hard to forget, especially when liberally basted with homemade cocktail sauce from a Gin Right squeeze bottle. The crowded clientele were tourists, fishermen, local black folks in their Sunday best, and white Georgian locals, who all seemed to bear an uncanny resemblance to Georgia humorist Louis Grizzard. The 2,400 students from 75 federal agencies who make up the FLETC population scarcely seemed to make a dent in the low-key local scene. The students looked like tourists, and the teachers seemed to have taken on much of the relaxed air of the Deep South. My host was Mr. Carlton Fitzpatrick, the program coordinator of the Financial Fraud Institute. Carlton Fitzpatrick is a mustached, sinewy, well-tanned Alabama native somewhere near his late 40s, with a fondness for chewing tobacco, powerful computers, and salty, down-home homilies. We'd met before, at FCIC in Arizona. The Financial Fraud Institute is one of 9 divisions at FLETC. Besides financial fraud, there's driver and marine, firearms, and physical training. These are specialized pursuits. There are also 5 general training divisions: basic training, operations, enforcement techniques, legal division, and behavioral science. Somewhere in this curriculum is everything necessary to turn green college graduates into federal agents. First, they're given ID cards. Then they get the rather miserable-looking blue coveralls known as Smurf suits. The trainees are assigned a barracks and a cafeteria, and immediately set on FLETC's bone-grinding physical training routine. Besides the obligatory daily jogging, the trainers run up danger flags beside the track when the humidity rises high enough to threaten heat stroke, there's the Nautilus machines, the martial arts, the survival skills. The 18 federal agencies who maintain on-site academies at FLETC employ a wide variety of specialized law enforcement units, some of them rather arcane. There's Border Patrol, IRS Criminal Investigation Division, Park Service, Fish and Wildlife, Customs, Immigration, Secret Service, and the Treasury's Uniform Subdivisions. If you're a federal cop and you don't work for the FBI, you train at FLETC. This includes people as apparently obscure as the agents of the Railroad Retirement Board Inspector General, or the Tennessee Valley Authority Police, who are in fact federal police officers and can and do arrest criminals on the federal property of the Tennessee Valley Authority. Then there are the computer crime people. All sorts, all backgrounds. Mr. Fitzpatrick is not jealous of his specialized knowledge. Cops all over, in every branch of service, may feel a need to learn what he can teach. Backgrounds don't matter much. Fitzpatrick himself was originally a Border Patrol veteran, then became a Border Patrol instructor at FLETC. His Spanish is still fluent, but he did find himself strangely fascinated when the first computer showed up at the training center. Fitzpatrick did have a background in electrical engineering, and though he never considered himself a computer hacker, he somehow found himself writing useful little programs for this new and promising gizmo. He began looking into the general subject of computers and crime, reading Don Parker's books and articles, keeping an ear cocked for war stories, useful insights from the field, the up-and-coming people of the local computer crime and high technology units. Soon he got a reputation around FLETC as the resident computer expert, and that reputation alone brought him more exposure, more experience, until one day he looked around, and sure enough, he was a federal computer crime expert. In fact, this unassuming, genial man may be the federal computer crime expert. There are plenty of very good computer people, and plenty of very good federal investigators. But the area where these worlds of expertise overlap is very slim. And Carlton Fitzpatrick has been right at the center of that since 1985, the first year of the colloquy, a group which owes much to his influence. He seems quite at home in his modest acoustic-tiled office, with its Ansel Adams-style Western photographic art, a gold-frame senior instructor certificate, and a towering bookcase crammed with 3-ring binders with such ominous titles as DataPro Reports on Information Security and CFCA Telecom Security 90. The phone rings every 10 minutes. Colleagues show up at the door to chat about new developments in locksmithing or to shake their heads at the latest dismal development in the BCCI global banking scandal. Carlton Fitzpatrick is a font of computer war stories, related in an acerbic drawl. He tells me the colorful tale of a hacker caught in California some years back. He'd been raiding systems, typing code without a detectable break for 20, 24, 36 hours straight. Not just logged on, typing. Investigators were baffled. Nobody could do that. Didn't he have to go to the bathroom? Was it some kind of automatic keyboard whacking device that could actually type code? A raid on the suspect's home revealed a situation of astonishing squalor. The hacker turned out to be a Pakistani computer science student who had flunked out of a California university. He'd gone completely underground as an illegal electronic immigrant and was selling stolen phone service to stay alive. The place was not merely messy and dirty, but in a state of psychotic disorder. Powered by some weird mix of culture shock, computer addiction, and amphetamines, the suspect had in fact been sitting in front of his computer for a day and a half straight, with snacks and drugs at hand on the edge of the desk and a chamber pot under his chair. Word about stuff like this gets around in the Hacker Tracker community. Carlton Fitzpatrick takes me for a guided tour by car around the Fletsy grounds. One of our first sites is the biggest indoor firing range in the world. There are federal trainees in there, Fitzpatrick assures me politely, blasting away with a wide variety of automatic weapons, Uzis, Glocks, AK-47s. He's willing to take me inside. I tell him I'm sure that's really interesting, but I'd rather see his computers. Carlton Fitzpatrick seems quite surprised and pleased. I'm apparently the first journalist he's ever seen who has turned down the shooting gallery in favor of microchips. Our next stop is the favorite with touring congressmen, the 3-mile-long Fletsy driving range. Here, trainees of the Driver and Marine Division are taught high-speed pursuit skills, setting and breaking roadblocks, diplomatic security driving for VIP limousines. A favorite Fletsy pastime is to strap a passing senator into the passenger seat beside a driver and marine trainer, hit 100 miles an hour, then take it right into the skid pan, a section of grease track where 2 tons of Detroit iron can whip and spin like a hockey puck. Cars don't fare well at Fletsy. First, they're rifled again and again for search practice. Then they do 25,000 miles of high-speed pursuit training. They get about 70 miles per set of steel-belted radials. Then it's off to the skid pan, where sometimes they roll and tumble headlong in the grease. When they're sufficiently grease-stained, dented, and creaky, they're sent to the roadblock unit, where they're battered without pity. And finally, they're sacrificed to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, whose trainees learn the ins and outs of car bombs by blowing them up into smoking wreckage. There's a railroad boxcar on the Fletsy grounds, and a large grounded boat, and a propless plane, all training grounds for searches. The plane sits forlornly on a patch of weedy tarmac next to an eerie blockhouse known as the Ninja Compound, where anti-terrorism specialists practice hostage rescues. As I gaze on this creepy paragon of modern low-intensity warfare, my nerves are jangled by a sudden staccato outburst of automatic weapons fire, somewhere in the woods to my right. 9mm, Fitzpatrick judges calmly. Even the Eldritch Ninja Compound pales somewhat compared to the truly surreal area known as the Raid Houses. This is a street lined on both sides with nondescript concrete blockhouses with flat pebbled roofs. They were once officers' quarters. Now they are training grounds. The first one to our left, Fitzpatrick tells me, has been specially adapted for computer search and seizure practice. Inside, it has been wired for video from top to bottom, with 18 pan-and-tilt remotely controlled video cams mounted on walls and in corners. Every movement of the trainee agent is recorded live by teachers for later taped analysis. Wasted movements, hesitations, possibly lethal tactical mistakes, all are gone over in detail. Perhaps the weirdest single aspect of this building is its front door, scarred and scuffed all along the bottom from the repeated impact, day after day, of federal shoe leather. Down at the far end of the row of raid houses, some people are practicing a murder. We drive by slowly as some very young and rather nervous-looking federal trainees interview a heavyset bald man on the raid house lawn. Dealing with murder takes a lot of practice. First, you have to learn to control your own instinctive disgust and panic. Then you have to learn to control the reactions of a nerve-shredded crowd of civilians, some of whom may have just lost a loved one, some of whom may be murderers, quite possibly both at once. A dummy plays the corpse. The roles of the bereaved, the morbidly curious, and the homicidal are played, for pay, by local Georgians. Waitresses, musicians, most anybody who needs to moonlight and can learn a script. These people, some of whom are Fletsy regulars year after year, must surely have one of the strangest jobs in the world. Something about the scene. Normal people in a weird situation, standing around talking in bright Georgia sunshine, unsuccessfully pretending that something dreadful has gone on, while a dummy lies inside on fake bloodstains, while behind this weird masquerade, like a set of nested Russian dolls, are grim future realities of real death, real violence, real murders of real people, that these young agents will really investigate many times during their careers, over and over. Will those anticipated murders look like this, feel like this? Not as real as these amateur actors are trying to make it seem, but both as real and as numbingly unreal as watching fake people standing around on a fake lawn. Something about this scene unhinges me. It seems nightmarish to me, Kafkaesque. I simply don't know how to take it. My head is turned around. I don't know whether to laugh, cry, or just shudder. When the tour is over, Carlton Fitzpatrick and I talk about computers. For the first time, cyberspace seems like quite a comfortable place. It seems very real to me suddenly, a place where I know what I'm talking about, a place I'm used to. It's real. Whatever. Carlton Fitzpatrick is the only person I've met in cyberspace circles who is happy with his present equipment. He's got a 5 meg RAM PC with a 112 meg hard disk, 660 megs on the way. He's got a Compaq 386 desktop, a Xena 386 laptop with 120 meg. Down the hall is a NEC NEC Multisync 2A with a CD-ROM drive and a 9600 baud modem with 4 comm lines. There's a training mini-computer, and a 10-meg local mini just for the center, and a lab full of student PC clones, and half a dozen Macs or so. There's a Data General MV2500 with 8 meg on board, and a 370 meg disk. Fitzpatrick plans to run a Unix board on the Data General when he's finished beta testing the software for it, which he wrote himself. It'll have email features, massive files on all manner of computer crime and investigation procedures, and will follow the computer security specifics of the Department of Defense Orange Book. He thinks it will be the biggest BBS in the federal government. Will it have FRAC on it? I ask, wryly. Sure, he tells me. FRAC, TAP, Computer Underground Digest, TM, all that stuff. With proper disclaimers, of course. I ask him if he plans to be the sysop. Running a system that size is very time-consuming, and Fitzpatrick teaches 2 3-hour courses every day. No, he says seriously. FLETC has to get its money's worth out of the instructors. He thinks he can get a local volunteer to do it. A high school student. He says a bit more, something I think about an Eagle Scout law enforcement liaison program, but my mind has rocketed off in disbelief. You're going to put a teenager in charge of a federal security BBS? I'm speechless. It hasn't escaped my notice that the FLETC Financial Fraud Institute is the ultimate hacker trashing target. There is stuff in here, stuff of such utter and consummate cool by every standard of the digital underground, I imagine the hackers of my acquaintance fainting dead away from forbidden knowledge greed fits, all at the mere prospect of cracking the super ultra top secret computers used to train the Secret Service in computer crime. Carlton, I babble, I'm sure he's a really nice kid and all, but that's a terrible temptation to set in front of someone who's just, you know, into computers and just starting out. Yeah, he says, that did occur to me. For the first time, I begin to suspect that he's pulling my leg. He seems proudest when he shows me an ongoing project called JICC, the Joint Intelligence Control Council. It's based on the services provided by EPIC, the El Paso Intelligence Center, which supplies data and intelligence to the Drug Enforcement Administration, the Customs Service, the Coast Guard, and the State Police of the 4 southern border states. Certain EPIC files can now be accessed by Drug Enforcement Police of Central America, South America, and the Caribbean, who can also trade information among themselves. Using a telecom program called White Hat, written by two brothers named Lopez from the Dominican Republic, police can now network internationally on inexpensive PCs. Carlton Fitzpatrick is teaching a class of drug agents from the Third World, and he's very proud of their progress. Perhaps soon the sophisticated smuggling networks of the Medellin cartel will be matched by a sophisticated computer network of the Medellin cartel's sworn enemies. They'll track boats, track contraband, track the international drug lords who now leap over borders with great ease, defeating the police through the clever use of fragmented national jurisdictions. JICC and EPIC must remain beyond the scope of this book. They seem to me very large topics, fraught with complications that I am not fit to judge. I do know, however, that the international computer-assisted network of police across national boundaries is something that Carlton Fitzpatrick considers very important, a harbinger of a desirable future. I also know that networks, by their nature, ignore physical boundaries. And I also know that where you put communications, you put a community, and when those communities become self-aware, they will fight to preserve themselves and to expand their influence. I make no judgments whether this is good or bad. It's just cyberspace. It's just the way things are. I asked Carlton Fitzpatrick what advice he would have for a 20-year-old who wanted to shine someday in the world of electronic law enforcement. He told me that the number one rule was simply not to be scared of computers. You don't need to be an obsessive computer weenie, but you mustn't be buffaloed just because some machine looks fancy. The advantages computers give smart crooks are matched by the advantages they give smart cops. Cops in the future will have to enforce the law with their heads, not their holsters. Today, you can make good cases without ever having to leave your office. In the future, Cops who resist the computer revolution will never get far beyond walking a beat. I asked Carlton Fitzpatrick if he had a single message for the public, some single thing that he would most like the American public to know about his work. He thought about it a while. "Yes," he said finally. "Tell me the rules, and I'll teach those rules." He looked me straight in the eye. "I do the best that I can." That's it for this week. Next week, part 4, The Civil Libertarians.